I'll start with an apology. I'm not a biologist. I'm not talking about biology. I'm only a physicist. I'm not talking about physics. I'm talking about engineering. And I'm not sure why I'm here. Actually, I am. I said I'd come. And so it's great. It's been terrific. But I want to tell you about something where we can actually do experiments on evolution. We've done one that's worked nicely. The first one took 4 years to do, but I think we're poised to do this now in like matters of weeks or something. But we need to know the right questions to ask. So I'm going to tell you something about microfluidics, and to do this, I'm going to first tell you a little bit. Some people have heard this already. I'm going to tell you a little bit, try and give you a little taste of what we can do. And you'll see after I've done why I want to do that, because then I want to show you some examples of what we do. And what I really like for you to do is to listen somewhat patiently and ask as many questions as you can, but then think about the things that you might think are worth doing if I show you what I think the power of what I'm trying to tell you about is. So, let's see, Murray, you maybe know Andrew Griffiths from when he worked at in Cambridge at the Molecular LMB or something, whatever it is. But he started us a long time ago, and Darren Link also was an early person. I think even Suliana may remember him. So this has been going on in my group for a long time, and this is the group of people who've done it. Most of what I'll tell you about is the work of Jeremy Agresti. And it has to do ultimately with being able to have new tools to look at things in a way that hasn't been possible before. So, I don't actually use these, but those of you who work in labs maybe recognize things like this. You can do modern biology, as far as I'm concerned, is really the science of a lot of information. We were talking about this last night, and there's a wealth of information, but there's never enough information. There's always the potential for more information, and I'm going to try and give you examples of what I mean by that. So these kinds of machines have made this more accessible. Basically, they're robots that mix and match fluids. They're like, this probably has 8 or 12 pipettes, and it goes and it takes a bunch of pipette tips and it moves and it takes some stuff, and you can do a lot of things, and each thing is done in a little well inside of these, and you have these plates. This probably has 96 plates on them, and I think the latest has like 3,000 plates, and you can do a lot of experiments that way. And similarly, if you want to look at single cells, or if you want to look at cells, you often like to understand how single cells behave. And we saw this morning how you can do this beautifully with looking, getting enormous amount of information by imaging. But you also can learn a lot about cells. And this has, again, been revolutionary in what we can do using these sort of cytometers, where you flow cells very rapidly by and look at their behavior. So these are kinds of instrumentations that have greatly enabled what you can do in biology or in biotechnology. In a sense, particularly the robots, you're not doing that much better than what you can do by hand. You're also limited. I'll show you what I mean. You're limited in the size. You can do very small volumes, but there's always a limit to everything. So, by the way, if you're not familiar with it, this is a plate of test tubes. These are like test tubes now. And so I want to show you that just as electronics has moved from the vacuum, you know, when I went to school, I actually took electronics course where we learned how vacuum tubes work. I don't think very many people can say that. You can, right? You remember how they work? That's what I learned in electronics. By the time I was graduating, they had integrated circuits, and now, of course, they have microprocessors. Well, there's a similar revolution in using the same technology for fluidics, and this is a chip that comes from Steve Quake, and so he's fairly local on this coast anyways, and he's done absolutely fantastic work, just beautiful work, building these chips where now you can mix and match just the way you do with robots, you can do it all with these microfluidic chips. And this is starting a new revolution. And I want to tell you something a little bit similar. The problem with these chips that Steve built, first of all, if you look at them, they are exceptionally complicated. And so this has been, it took him, you can actually buy these now, but I think it took that like 2 years to learn how to manufacture them properly. Moreover, it's like all glassware, you have to wash things afterwards. Basically, you are controlling the fluids and the reagents in the device. So I'm going to show you how all these things are constructed. This is a wonderful way of doing things, but again, if you're looking at mixing, say, proteins, which will stick to anything, and you want to mix them, then you have to worry about fouling the channels, because the channels contain the reagents, and just like you're mixing with the pipette, you have to throw the tip of the pipette out when you do something new. You have to wash these devices, and washing them is somewhat difficult. Let me make one aside, and that is that this chip, as I told you, you can buy. And what I'm going to tell you about today is something that in the end becomes technologically challenging enough that you can start doing this in a research group in a university, but in the long run, a lot of it has to get pushed to companies. And so the reason, and I'll show you examples of that, which has come from my lab, the reason is just it's too complicated to actually make these things work to do in just a simple research lab in university. But the power that you can see makes it worthwhile to do this. So this chip will analyze something, I don't know, maybe 1,000, I would say something easily 10,000 different samples. They're maybe nanoliters to hundreds of nanoliters in volume. You can fill them. I think this one has, I'm not sure the latest, but they have like 42 separate inputs, and you can take a little bit from each of these and you can mix them together. And you can do something like 10 to the fourth samples in of the order of an hour. So that's now really getting to be large scale automation. But it's still limiting. So what I want to tell you about is thinking about these, but not having everything laid out in the same way. Notice that this is a 384 well plate. It's all laid out the way you think of random access memory in these parallel arrays, like these square arrays. The same here. This is like, looks exactly like a chip. I want to think about things slightly differently. And I want to take each of these wells and replace it by a little drop. And this little drop is going to be my test tube. It's going to be a well in one of these 384 well plates, or whatever the latest size is. However, I'm going to show you that this has enormous advantages. So first of all, I can make them very uniform. Secondly, I think I have some numbers somewhere here. I'll show you these numbers. Here are the numbers why this becomes sort of interesting. If I make a 1 micron drop, that's a little small for what I can do, but a 1 micron drop has a femtoliter. 10 to the minus 15 liters. A 10 micron drop has a picoliter. Now, you might wonder, why do I want to do that? There are actually two reasons for why I want to do that. One of them is shown here. It's just cells. Did you ever think why nature adopts a cell? So you guys know, I'm never going to even possibly know the things you forget, but I have a very simple-minded way of looking at it. And that is that in the end, you want all of life depends on chemical reactions. And chemical reactions, the rate at which chemical reactions go, depends on concentration. And if you want to have a high concentration, but you don't want to use a lot of molecules, like one genome, what do? You have a small volume. So you constrain things to a small volume. That's an easy way of getting the reactions up. So guess what? This is a bacterium. A bacterium is a few microns in diameter. It's a few femtoliters. One molecule in a femtoliter is a nanomolar. That's sort of the concentrations you need for good catalytic reactions to go. So that's a very simple reason why you want to have confinement. You want to have information that's locked in some region. You want chemical reactions to go in some period of time. And, you know, we can do it in a cell or we can do it in a drop. I'm going to show you that we can do just about everything else that we want in a drop. Then I'm going to show you that I can do all kinds of things by manipulating the drops, and I can do it at high enough rates that I no longer have to think about these parallel arrays that I carefully fill, but rather I want to think of using a whole bunch of little reactors very, very rapidly, where I'm constraining things so I can boost the reaction just by having a low volume. The other advantage, of course, is that this is now separating two different things. I have a test tube, and I have a way of controlling the test tubes. In the traditional microfluidics geometries, you don't separate them. You pass the reagents down these channels, and you can foul the channels because proteins can stick to the channels. You're always washing. If you have a little test tube, you can put this in a separate fluid. The inert carrier fluid can be the control fluid for the fluidics, and you just have to control the drop, which contains what you want, which contains your reagents. So I better worry a bit about the surfactants. I'm not going to tell you a lot. This was, 2 years of work. Finally, we had somebody who really figured out we had to make his own surfactants. The reason is that the inert fluid that we use, because we're using proteins, because we're using DNA a lot, I'm going to show you a lot to do with that, the inert carrier fluid is a fluorinated oil. And fluorinated oils are not as common as normal hydrocarbon oils, so we had to find a really good surfactant to coat the walls of the drops. What we did eventually was we made essentially a diblock copolymer. One side is soluble in the fluorocarbon. The other side is PEG, and the PEG is on the inside of the drop, and PEG is a very inert molecule. So we have, think of a small water drop with a layer of PEG around it. And the surfactant does two things. It keeps the wall of the drop inert, and it stabilizes the drop against coalescence. So this is important, but it's a problem that's been solved. I won't show you about it. So what can we do? So the thing about these robots is that they're really good at precisely manipulating fluids. And they really do this by, you know, you literally go down and you have these wells and you suck something up there, but basically pipettes. And they're automatic and they change their pipette tips, and it's really impressive technology. So what could we do? And I'm going to give you, before I tell you more about the technology, let me tell you something about what we might like to do, what we might have the ability to do, and this is a conference on evolution, so let me tell you a little bit about that. So how do you make an enzyme? I don't think I have the numbers here, but correct me if I'm wrong, a typical enzyme might have like 300 amino acids, and I could say, well, I want to do this sort of a stupid way. I want to take all the different possibilities. So that's 300 to the 20th.
No, but the other way around.
20 to 300. Okay, sorry. And that is...
They're both big, yeah.
So that is, let's see, that is, I think that's bigger than the number of possibilities that string theorists have for the number of universes. So, you know, you can get to large numbers. You shouldn't be afraid of the string theorists, that there's large numbers here too. So how do you do that? Well, you might say, well, I want to learn how to do that, but that's actually difficult. So there's another way, and that is that you can use evolution, right? Yeah.
I don't mean to take this in a digression, but if you're not going to talk about this later on. So the thing that always seems intriguing about microfluidics is that, unlike electronics, the physics changes as you change the size scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there are obvious ways that we should think about not just the surface chemistry, but also how the fluidics actually changes.
So you're absolutely right that physics changes when you change the size scale. It changes when you get down to a few nanometers. I'm never going to go there. So everything I tell you, the physics hasn't changed a bit.
Okay.
So there's no, pardon?
Even
not mixing, no. There's nothing new. There's nothing that a simple understanding of the Navier-Stokes equations won't tell you. There's zero new physics, I'm sorry. I wish there were, but there isn't. There's a few things that you're not used to because the scale is small. Yes, you have to learn how to mix a little better. Those are really easy, really, very easy. So there's no new physics. I told you, this is engineering. It's not physics. There's no new physics at these scales. And the only place there's new physics is if you go down to, say, 10 nanometers and below. And the new physics is not so complicated. It's just because it's all interface and it's all surfaces, so you have to understand it differently. But really, there's not new physics. So there is a lot of statements that there's new physics with microfluids, but it's not true. Okay, so this is what I say you might want to do, is you might want to do what's called directed evolution. So I'm going to tell you my simple physicist way of understanding what this is. It's nothing more than trying to make a better, say, catalyst, protein, enzyme. I'm going to talk about enzymes. It's nothing more than trying to make a better enzyme by doing, in principle, what nature does. And that is that I use the fact that the enzyme, it's coded for by a gene. There's some gene that codes for that. And so if I take that gene, and I do exactly what nature does to evolve something, that is, I mix it up. I make a new set of genes that has some mistakes in it. I can do that by amplifying that gene, trying to make copies of it, but doing it in a way that's not perfect, but has errors in it. Or I can do that by chopping it up into smaller bits and mixing them and reassembling them. I can do both ways. But I can essentially make a library of new genes. And these genes are different from the parent gene, but they're somehow derived from the parent gene. And then what I can do is take each gene. I have now some library of genes. And I can take each gene, and I can ask, I can translate that gene into the enzyme, and I can ask a simple question. Let's say I'm looking at an enzyme. It's some catalyst. Does it work better? I can just sort through that and find out whether it does. And so somehow I have to keep track, though, of the gene and the enzyme. So the genotype and the phenotype have to somehow be linked together. And then if I can find something that works better, I can identify a new enzyme. And that's how nature does it in principle. That's how at least the simple-minded picture of evolution works. So you can do that. The problem is that even that, if you go through the numbers, is a huge number of different choices. So you can't, no matter how fast you do it, you can't really try everything. You want to somehow be clever about it. Now, how's that done today? Do I have a slide on that? Yeah, so it's done with robots, and or it's actually done by hand. The best I know, I'm sure I don't know everything, but the best I know is what you do is you take these libraries, and usually you use some cell, either a bacterium or a yeast or something, to do the translation from the gene into the enzyme. And you make this library from the yeast, and then there's this beautiful set of tricks that biochemists have. They make, you know, they make sure that if it actually produces something, the cell will survive. And then what you have to do is you take all the cells, all the bacteria, you plate them out one by one by one, and let them grow into colonies and grow them up so you have a detectable amount. And then you go and you take a little bit of that, you lyse the cell, you purify it, you take the enzyme, you do an ELISA test or something, and do I have that written down here? Yeah, you do an ELISA test to see if this works better. Use something to see if it works better. So the largest number that I know of, and I could be totally wrong, but the largest number that I know of that people have tried to look at is something like a library of 1,000, because it's a lot of work to do each of these things. And if you have this huge number of possible samples, you need different strategies, a lot of worry about the strategy. So I want to try and show you that, oh, here's the number, sorry. I want to show you that there are other ways that you can really improve on this now by a lot. And this lets you ask new questions about really what the evolution, the nature of the evolution is of these new genes. So if I want to do that, I want to do that using these microfluidics and using drops. So I want to use the drops as little test tubes where I can put a single gene somehow, and I want to do this in a way that I can ask, does that do something new? So here's what I say that I have to do with the drops. And I just want to show you that now it's feasible to do that. So bear with me, I'm going to show you just a little engineering, but it's sort of fun because there's nice pictures. So I better be able to make uniform drops. That's like having the same amount of material in my test tubes. I have to fill them. I might want to do several assays on what's inside them, so I might want to split the drops. The most important thing is that I want to somehow start a reaction. I'll show you oftentimes you want to start it. For example, you want to produce the enzyme and you want to add the substrate. That's like initiating into a reaction. The best way to do that is to mix two drops together. One has the substrate, the other has the enzyme. So I better be able to have the reaction take place. Then I want to detect what's inside the drops. And if it's really valuable, I want to sort this. And I want to do this in very large numbers. So let me just show you now that that's all feasible using microfluidics. So the way we do this is we take advantage of we build chips by taking advantage of, basically, when we decided we wanted to do this, we went across the street, and my colleague George Whitesides has everything set up, and he's invented something that he calls soft lithography. And really, it's nothing fancy. It's just that rather than doing everything in silicon or silica, which is glass, which is the right way of doing things, George says, well, that's great, but if I want to make a chip in glass, it takes roughly a month to build a chip. And that's, you get a beautiful chip, but if you make one mistake, it's a month later. For us, we build chips, it takes us 2 days. Of course, if you're like me, I say, why 2 days? Why not 1 day? The reason is that there's one part that we need, which is sort of our mass that we you'll see where we use this. And we use a very, very high-tech way of making it. It's ultimate in high-tech. We use a printer, a laser printer. But it's a real high-resolution laser printer, and so the closest place that we had one in Cambridge that did it, and they somehow lost resolution, so we found another one. It's in California. So literally, the extra day is that we have to email our CAD file with this pattern to a print shop in California. They print a mask, and they FedEx it back. You know, FedEx takes a night, so it takes 2 days. Otherwise, it would take 1 day. And so this is what we do. It's really very simple. It's the beauty of soft lithography is you use silicon rubber. It's the same stuff that you seal the windows of your car or your bathtub, your kitchen. What you do is you take just a flat surface, we use silicon, and you put a polymer that you can polymerize with UV. And then you take this mask, which took the extra day, which is literally just something that blocks the light, except for the pattern you want, and you expose this photoresist to this pattern with the UV light. And when it's polymerized, it's just polymerized here. And so you can wash everything else away, and now you have something with just these ridges here, and these ridges will form the channels that you want to form. And then the soft lithography is nothing more than literally pouring silicon rubber on top of this. Silicon rubber, you know what the consistency of silicon rubber is, soft, that's why it's soft. You can peel it off once it hardens, so you can peel it off, and you're left with something that has the channels in. And that's really all there is to it. And for what we do, this is really all very simple. Then you put another glass slide, you seal the channels, you connect it to the outside world with a hole punch, you just punch some holes in it, and you're done. This is an example. This is, by the way, this is the resolution of the laser printer that we use. This is 5 micron resolution. And we always use, with the channels that we use are always something like 15 microns or so, a little bit larger. And the reason for that is not that we can't go to smaller channels, it's just that a piece of dust is about 5 microns. If you have all the channels a little larger than that, you never have to worry about dust, you have a little clogging. All very simple. We can do smaller channels, okay. So what can we do? We can make uniform drops. This was first something that Steve did, very nice. And it's really very simple. All you do is you have your drop, which is going to be water, flowing in here, and you have the carrier fluid just pulling it off. And this is what it looks like. This is the water coming in, and the carrier fluid, which is oil, just pulls it off. And you can see it makes very uniform drops. It makes them roughly 1 per second, right? Actually, all the movies that I'm going to show you, a bunch of movies, they're all taken with a high-speed camera. So these are making several thousand per second.
Is it dropping because of gravity?
No. This is...
is there a flow of oil?
Sorry. The oil is flowing this way. This is 30 microns, so gravity is just too small. And actually, I'm glad you asked, because here you can see there's little particles. These are little beads in it. And just watch the beads. Watch this first frame. See the way they're swirling? They're swirling because you get the viscous drag of the oil. It's flowing, and it's dragging the drop off.
What's the speed of the oil flow?
Do I have that? 1 liter in 40 days.
So you have a special pump.
You have a special pump. It's called a syringe pump. I think I have it written down here. This is, you can see, they're roughly, yeah, this is the oil is flowing at 25 microliters an hour, 50 microliters an hour. 750 microliters an hour. You're just increasing. Notice what happens, you increase the flow of the oil, the drops get smaller. So you can control the size. Okay, so that's about the flow rates. So if you're thinking of trying to make macroscopic quantities, this is, you want to be careful. It turns out you can do it. I'll show you ways that you can do it later. But you have to be careful, but you don't want to do macroscopic quantities, you want to make lots of drops. And so this is making, this one here was making 3,000 drops per second. Okay, so if you were doing the same as a, what is it, 3084, no, a 384 well plate, you'd be doing 10 plates per second. That's not bad, 10 plates per second. And you can change the size. Here's another way of making it. This is, was invented, was first done by my former colleague, Howard Stone. It's the same thing. There's oil flowing this way, but now I have oil flowing both ways, water flowing this way, and everything is pushed through a narrow hole, and that causes drops to be formed. You can see that here. Same rate. I get very uniform drops. So we can make drops. We can fill the drops. This is where maybe you were worried about the physics being different, and things are different because the scale is small, so you have to worry about small scales. So here everything's flowing, and this is actually three fluids flowing together, and they're not mixing. They're not mixing because it's laminar flow. It's laminar flow because the dimensions are small. But okay, we know that. It turns out once you form the drops, as soon as you disrupt the flow field, then it mixes. And so all you have to do is disrupt the flow field. If you want to mix it faster, you just put a few curves here, and then it mixes really easily. But here we can fill the drops with whatever we want, and we can put whatever sort of thing that we like into it, and then it mixes very nicely in the drops.
The surfactant's
in the continuous phase.
It's in the continuous phase.
So the surfactant covers the drop at this point where it's made. Always for stabilizing drops, you want the surfactant in the continuous phase.
And it absorbs very fast.
Absorbs fast enough. As you can see, in all these cases, the drops are well separated, so it doesn't really matter. You just want to make it get to the surface well enough to protect the surface and to keep the drops from coalescing. If you want to split the drops, you can do the same thing. You use the same T-junction, but now you just shoot the drops in, and they can't decide which way to go, so they go both ways, and they pull themselves apart. And here we split them into two equal, so you can do two assays on one drop. They don't have to be equal. You can make them small. You can take a little small amount off or take a large amount off. Turns out this just depends on the hydrodynamic resistance. This is a longer channel, higher resistance. This is a soft material, so you can actually adjust it dynamically just by squeezing down on it. So it's a dynamic thing if you want it. You can split the drops. Of course, you can do other things with this. Here we're splitting them 1, 2, 3 times. Notice we're taking these big slugs and making uniform drops underneath, and we just split them several times. So, okay, you can do all these sort of things. You want to combine drops. You want to initiate a chemical reaction. This turns out is actually interesting. It's interesting in terms of, at least as far as I can tell. We were far from the first group to work with microfluidics, and if you look at the really important people in the field, people like Steve Quake and Mike Ramsey, who was at Oak Ridge at the time, the ones who really started this field, they all started with drops, and they all moved away from drops. And as far as I can tell, the reason they did that is because of the surfactant and because of the ability, the importance of mixing drops, and actually the difficulty of that. Now, you should think that making drops mix should be very easy, because you work so hard, and I told you it took us 2 years to get a surfactant. If you have no surfactant, they should mix really easily. It turns out it's not quite so easy. Let me show you what I mean by that. So this is our first experiment. And we basically have a drop maker here and a drop maker here, and we're just shooting the drops at each other and asking them to please coalesce, please initiate a reaction, and they don't do it. And the reason they don't is because we understand the physics again. These ones all go to the bottom, these ones all go to the top because of the flow lines. The flow lines just don't mix. Okay, well, that's easy. We just make the drops a little larger, and then they can't go through the hole at the same time, and then they'll definitely mix. And so we did that, and look what happens. And look what happens. I'm going to show this in a blow-up down here. Watch this carefully. Here, you see they come together. Now look, they are really close together, and they should just coalesce, right? Come on, guys. They don't. Why? It's the same reason that the oil in your car works the way that it does. And that is that if I have two flat regions and I have some oil between them, I try and squeeze it out, it takes a force to squeeze it out. It's called a lubrication force. It's the thing that lubricates, why oil lubricates. Basically, they don't stay together long enough and they never coalesce. And so really, it turns out coalescence is a difficult problem to solve. So how do you do that? You need to do something other than just having hydrodynamic effects. So we did something simple. We add an electric field. Here's an early implementation of this. We have these two droplet makers. They're getting close, but we've put charges in each drop. Now, the nice thing about charges is you can use plus and minus, right? And so if we turn on the field, it works perfectly. Okay, so now we can mix them real easy. This is actually the way we do it now. What I showed you before, I really did use charge, and it turns out that charging water is somewhat problematic. If you want to charge water, you have to have some electrochemical interaction to put electrons into the water or take electrons out of the water. And that means electrochemistry, and you really don't want to do that. But the nice thing about oil is its dielectric constant's really low. The nice thing about water is its dielectric constant's really high. So if I take an electric field and put it across a drop of water inside oil, it turns out that I induce a dipole. If I have two drops together and I put an electric field on, I induce a dipole in each of them. Now the nice thing about dipoles, for those of you who don't remember electrodynamics, freshman physics, one thing I can teach, two dipoles like this attract. So here we're putting drops together. Notice, by the way, we put little drops and large drops. The reason for doing that is the little drops always catch up to the large drops because they actually move a little faster. This one always catches up. And here now I'm going to add an electrode and just put an electric field on. And every time it comes to the electric field, boom, coalesces. And now I don't have to charge these. I just use this dielectric forces. Okay. So I can combine drops now. I can incubate them. Well, that just means a long channel, right? A long channel. Turns out this is pretty good. This is pretty good. I can make a channel that maybe incubates things for about 20 minutes. But if I want to incubate longer, there's lots of other tricks I can play. I can make a wider channel. And notice that now the drops, if I keep the volume fraction large, the drops actually flow as a plug. Right? So they retain their order. So if I want to have first in, first out, I retain my order. If I want to incubate this, I can incubate probably for an hour on a chip. If I want to incubate even longer, I can take the drops just off the chip and then just load them onto a new chip. And then I can incubate for a long time. And I'll show you examples where you can do something. Okay, if I want to detect the reactions, well, we saw this morning this incredibly beautiful way of imaging. And you can image through PDMS. It's very clear. It's optically very good. It turns out that you actually can image this better than most things because you can squish the drops down. You can get rid of the interfaces. You can really do it quite well. And so you can just optically image things. Now, if we're flowing them at several thousand a second, then the imaging that you normally do is not really so easy. So what you do is you just detect colors, fluorescence, or something like that. But you can do that pretty easily. You can, for example, detect fluorescence. So here's an example. These drops have dye. You can see whenever they go through the laser, they light up. This is the setup. It's not important, but it's all relatively simple. And you can do exactly the same thing with fluorescence detection. Using a photomultiplier tube, you have no problems. Plenty of signal to do this. Okay, this is really important. If you want to really screen things, you really want to be able to pick things out. You want to sort things. So how do I do that? Well, I've already showed you the basics. This is the, again, early implementation. This is, again, using electric charges and fields. So these drops are charged. Notice they go left or right sort of randomly. See if you can figure out which way they actually go. That's a homework problem. But they go roughly randomly, but this has an electric field, so I can say, okay, guys, go to the right. Turn on the electric field, they all go to the right. Go to the left. I'll go to the left. I just change electric field. This is really pretty easy. Again, I don't really want to use electric field. I want to use a dielectric field. And the thing about a dielectric field is that an electric field, a field puts a dipole, a gradient of a field puts a force. So I just have to use a gradient field, and these electrodes put a gradient field. There's a detector here, and watch what happens. These are black and white. If you carefully look, all the black go to the top, all the white go down here. Okay, this is designed that this is essentially a larger channel, so they all want to go this way, except when you detect a white one, you turn an electric field that pulls them down. This now doesn't use charges, it does use dielectric forces, and we can pull one drop out with 4,000 per second. So you can sort at 4,000 or 5,000 per second, and you can sort arbitrarily, just triggered by your detector. Okay, the last thing is that if you really want to do this, it turns out there's one important other parameter, and you'll see when I tell you what the things that you can start dreaming about doing, you'll see it's important. That is that I want to have everything in these picoliter drops. And what I don't want to do is have some robot come and take the drops and do things. That would slow everything down. So the way to avoid that, the way to deal with a large library is to use a barcode. So I want to put things in the drops, like make a library in the drops, and in addition, I want to put some optical barcode inside that drop so I know what it is and I can read it at the same rate that I'm sorting it. Just add a few lasers. And there's lots of ways of doing that. Here's a simple way. So how I could do this is, imagine I have a library of n different compounds, and this n is going to get pretty large for some of the things I'm going to tell you about. If I have a library with n different compounds, the way that the library exists, by the way, is on these plates, right? Maybe in some minus 80 degree freezer. What I do is I take each of the compounds separately and then make them into drops. But for each drop, I add some kind of barcode. And remember, these are different materials that I very carefully separated out. Okay? Then I make each of them into an emulsion, so I hold them in emulsion, and then I do something that's absolutely heretical. I take all of them and I mix them together. And I can do that because I have a barcode in each one. And then every time I want to do an experiment, I just take an aliquot of that and feed that in. And it's random, but I have this barcode. And so now it's all in an emulsion. It's all on the scale that I want. It's all in the test tubes that I want. And I just have to mix them in to something else. How can you do that? Well, you can do this by, for example, using fluorophores. Now, one fluorophore, you could maybe change the concentration of the fluorophore, and you get, I don't know, 10 different concentrations, 10 measurable levels. But you can do something else with fluorophores. You can take the fluorophore and attach it to different size molecules. A really good thing is just attach it to a piece of DNA, different size DNA. And the nice thing about fluorophores is that they tumble, they rotate, they rotationally diffuse while they're emitting light. And so if you look at the light, if you hit it with polarized light, if you excite it with polarized light, you measure the amount of polarized emission and depolarized emission. That is that depends on how much the molecule has rotated. That's called fluorescence depolarization. If you slow it down by putting it onto a bigger molecule, you slow down, you change the degree of depolarization. So if you measure the depolarized light, just add an extra detector, you have another axis of the same number of fluorophores. So here's an example where, for example, there's a bunch of different fluorescent intensities and a bunch of different degrees of depolarization. Each of these now, across here, becomes a label. I just change the concentration, so I have to measure the intensity and the degree of depolarization. And if you run through this with with one fluorophore, you can easily get 1,000 labels. With two fluorophores, just two fluorophores, you have 1,000,000 labels. So there's a way of making a barcode. Very simple. And it works. Okay, so let me show you now. Let me go back. Oh, this is the simplest thing. So this is the simplest thing. So Darren Link, let's see. Darren Link started a little company to try and take advantage of this. And this is the absolute simplest thing you can do. So we were talking the other day about doing sequencing, right? And you say there's a lot of sequence information. It turns out, though, that a lot of the times when you do sequencing, you don't really, you said last night, in fact, it's easier just to sequence everything. But many times you don't want to sequence everything. You want to just sequence certain regions of the genome. This is particularly if you're studying diseases. You want to just, typically what you want to do is sequence all the SNPs, right? You want to do genotyping. If you sequence the whole genome, even now you can do it, but it's, I don't know, varying cost, $40,000, whatever it is, a couple of weeks, it's not something you can do very easily. If there was a simple way of just sequencing those regions you want, then that would greatly reduce the time and the cost. And there is a way. What you do is you build a library of primers that will just amplify by PCR those regions around those portions that you want. So what you want to do is amplify just the regions that you're interested in. You could do that if you know where they are, you just build primers around them. And then what you do is you make a library of primers. So each drop has one set of primers for one region. And you put a little of the genomic DNA in that, and then you take all the drops, you just combine them, and you take all the drops and you do PCR in the drops. And that amplifies only those regions that you're interested in. But you have to do a little cleaning up. But this is a really, really simple thing. And that way, you can amplify only those regions that you want. So that's called genomic selection. The only thing you need to use, I think I have a picture of it, the only thing you need to use is this drop combiner. You have a library of drops. This one drop will contain the genomic DNA. The other drop contains some random primer. You don't care what it is. You just put enough primers in, and you amplify it, and then you just pick out those regions that you want. And this really works. And so this is, this is a long slide, but this is, Darren has a little company. It's called Raindance Technologies. I think they now have like 70 employees. They're in the D round of funding. It's in Lexington. You can buy this machine. You can buy it from Raindance Technologies. I told you that in the end, you can't do this in your lab. I couldn't do it in my lab, and Darren just started a company. It's taken about 3 years to build this instrument. This is the simplest instrument.
How the primer thing works? So you have all the primers for all your SNPs mixed together?
Each, you have an emulsion, and each drop has one set of primers for one SNP. And so it takes some random DNA and it amplifies. Actually, it turns out you actually can put 3 or 4 different sets of primers, because the likelihood of having the same information you shear down the genomic DNA, the likelihood of having the same SNPs, two SNPs is very small, so you can put lots of them in. You want to just do that. So you just do that with all the drops, and then each drop has, it amplifies that section of the genomic DNA that has the SNP that you want. Then you take all the emulsions, you amplify with PCR, you break the emulsion, and you're left just with amplified regions, so you sequence everything. So there's one or two, you know, the amount of genomic DNA that's left, the original DNA is small. What you're really sequencing is just that part of the DNA that you want. So that's a perfect way of running with modern second generation sequencing machines.
How you get the, I mean, there's a pair of primers for each SNP.
Yeah.
So how do you get them all paired up?
what you do is you make offline, you have basically a robot that goes in and sips up some set of primers and all the PCR reagents.
Ordered in some way.
No, you don't have to be ordered. Because you make an emulsion with all of them, and then you mix everything together, and you take a little aliquot. In the aliquot, there may be a million drops, well, maybe 1,000 drops of each of the primers on average. Okay, so it's 1,000 plus or minus the square root of 1,000, it doesn't matter, but it's just some random number of those things. And that's, you mix them all together, and so you're mixing 1,000 drops of each pair of primers. And you're doing PCR with those. Then you break that.
Most times the pairs don't match up.
That's why you can do multiplexing and you add several different primers. So you hope, you want to adjust it so on average you hit once. Yeah.
And you just do this by the concentration of the primers in the solution wet, and you know how many molecules to leave per drop.
Exactly. It's all very simple. And so, and if it doesn't work, okay, you've added an extra picoliter to your solution. Well, that's not so bad. You know, it doesn't matter. There's not much that's going to be sequenced compared to the amplified stuff.
The other way around, where you're assaying a mixture of single molecules of DNA, and you want to just amplify one region to see what the diversity is. Can you bring it down to one molecule of the test in one droplet, and then PCR amplify?
Yes. Let me show you. You can, you absolutely, if you amplify things like that, it works just fine. And so you can do, there are situations where you might want to do something like that. I'll show you some examples of that. Okay, so let me go back now to what I talked about at the beginning, and that is to show you how you can use this for directed evolution and ask some interesting questions about it. So we chose something very simple. We chose an enzyme called horseradish peroxidase, HRP. It is a very fast enzyme. It is within a factor of 10 of being diffusion limited. The nice thing about horseradish peroxidase, it's sort of boring, but the reason why it's important is that there's a substrate that it works on, that it operates on, that turns it turns it fluorescent. It's amplex red. It oxidizes that. You get resorufin, which is a dye, which is a fluorescent dye. So it's an easy way of seeing its efficiency by just asking how much fluorescence you have. So we did this, we used a trick. You don't need to do this. You can do this all in vitro, but it turns out there's some interesting problems which I can talk about having to do with statistics if you do it in vitro. You always want to amplify things if you can. So the way we did it was we used surface display of yeast to do the translation of the gene into the enzyme. So what you do is you make the gene, you take it and put it into a plasmid, you put it into yeast, one plasmid per yeast, and there are ways, I don't know how to do this, but biochemists do this all the time, and we work with a group at MIT who does this. Basically, the yeast will express the enzyme and have it come to the surface of the yeast. And there's something like 50,000 enzymes that are expressed on the surface of the yeast. And then they're still functional. They're not quite as good. They don't work quite as well, but they still work. So you can get them to express the HRP on its surface. And that HRP now will operate on a substrate and make it fluoresce. But if it's in a drop, then everything, the fluorescence is trapped in the drop. So here's an example. These are yeasts where they've made fluorescent substrates. The other ones, these are all expressing HRP, so only the ones with cells actually have fluorescence. So this is what we do.
But in each drop, you have how many different cells?
in each drop? One, average one. Those were budding.
I understand, so the fluctuation in each, because I mean, the coating is uniform, I suppose, it varies from cell to cell.
Yeah, so let me show you how you deal with that. Okay, you'll see in a second, it's easy. So what we do is we make a library of genes. Do you have a question? No. Make a library of genes, put one gene per yeast cell, put one yeast cell per drop, mix in the substrate with this combination, and then just let it act and see, measure the fluorescence. And then we use our sorter and pull out the fluorescent drops. And you're right that we have variation. So what we do is we just sort and pull out more than we necessarily want. We set the threshold somewhat low. And then we break the emulsion, grow up the yeast, and do it again. And do that several times. And that's the easy thing that you can do if you're using cells to do this.
How long is the yeast in the droplet?
Order an hour. You might ask, how long do cells survive in droplets? So I'll show you some examples where we use cells. Yeast will survive a long time.
Is there any nutrients in this droplet?
No. Mammalian cells will survive much less time. But I'll show you examples where we have mammalian cells that easily will survive 6 hours. You make the drops larger, they'll survive longer. It's just a matter of how much nutrients you put in. Okay. The beauty of this, by the way, is that you can take this whole device and you can put it in an incubator because it's permeable to gas. So oxygen and CO2 go right through the fluorocarbons in the PDMS. So it's just limited by the nutrients. And we've done tests to show that. Okay. Yeah.
I was just wondering, what's the advantage of yeast over using a phage display system to do the same thing?
The phage will detect binding and will only detect strong binding versus no binding. This, we're going to detect activity. You can't use phage for detecting activity.
The fact that you get a large number of molecules per cell, right?
That's nice. It's not essential, but if you do it, somehow you need to amplify to detect, and one molecule is probably not enough, so having some amplification is nice. You can do it all with in vitro translation. Then you're limited, and there's a lot of noise that turns on that. This is less noise just because it's more greater amplification. But you can overcome the variation in the production by doing several sorts. So, okay, I've showed you now how we do this, right? Where this is we make the drops, we incubate. Actually, it turns out that we can just add, we have two flows. We add the substrate at the same time as we encapsulate the drops. We run it at, so roughly a third of the drops have a cell, so we only have one cell per drop. So most of them are empty, but you see some have cells. We incubate, then we sort. We detect, we sort, and we just choose them. And so here's some of the results. So the first thing that we did was we set the threshold for detection at the same level as the parent. We didn't look for something that works better. We looked for something that works the same. And we started a sort. So the first, this is the amount of fluorescence that you would measure if all the drops had the parent cell in them. And this is the average amount of fluorescence that the whole library measures. So here, there's very few drops that have anything, and we sort them once and twice, and eventually it doesn't change. We do several sorts. Okay, each time between them, we grow up the cells. We're growing up just the ones we've sorted out, and we sort again. And so we can do this. And we get, after this, we got a library, and we took something like 100 of them, 100 different ones, and we sequenced them. We can measure what we had. Oh, by the way, this is the actual amount. This is the parent parent enzyme, and you can see we had one that was three times as much. Most of them were roughly the same as the parent. And we take this, and these are the collection of mutations, and I'm not enough of a biochemist to say what these mutations meant, but we can use the statistics, since we sequence about 100, some were the same, some were different, we can just use the statistics to suggest that it should be roughly 200 unique mutations that work approximately as well as the parent.
Mutagen in this whole thing?
Yeah, sorry. We did mutagenesis. We did two things. We did mutagenesis for one. So we introduced a few errors per enzyme, and we did some shuffling. Okay? And they both gave the same results. Okay. And what I should have said is that we used a library of 10 to the 7. So we're looking at 10 to the 7. And then we should have taken all, but we took 20 of them. And we used this we took just the genes for those 20 better ones. Now these are mixed, and we use them as a product to do a second round of mutagenesis. And now when we do it, and we look, we started to find things that worked factors of 10 or 12 better. Okay, so now we found huge increases when we did this second round of screening.
I understand. How do you do second round of mutagenesis? Do you take them out of yeast cells and then retransform?
Yeah, exactly. So we use them, the selected ones, as the library. Before we used one, now we used 20 of them. And now we started to find a lot that worked better. And in fact, if you do a simple calculation, the factor of 12 better, which was the best, is really, it's within a factor of 4 of diffusion limited. So you could make it a factor of 4 better, but that's it. So you're really getting to where you're saturating. Okay. I'm sorry?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're already a factor of 4 from where we could. But we did. Yeah, we could do it again, but we didn't. Why didn't we do it again? The person who did this really, literally, spent 4 years doing this.
But that brief.
No. I'll show you how much it's developing it. But it got to the point where I was trying to tell him, you really should write a paper. You really should write a paper.
But how long did it take for the second round?
Let me show you the numbers. Do I have the numbers? These are the...
These are the first round.
I have the number. Can I come back to that in a minute?
I just want to know roughly. It'll take a week to do the second round. It sounds fast to me. as soon as you got it.
So look. Figure it out. 10 to the 7. We use the library of 10 to the 7. We do, 10 to the 3 per second. Mm-hmm. So it's 10 to the 4 seconds.
That's about...
A couple hours,
yeah.
Right? Do that 3-4 times?
Yeah.
3 hours.
So then it would just take another day to do the
thing. Your rate limiting step is getting the plasmids back out of the yeast and preparing these up.
And you better sequence them, and you better... Yeah. So, no, we could do it. It really would have taken another month to do that. But it just didn't seem to make sense. And for other sociological reasons, it turned out we had to write the paper right away.
But it isn't just a matter of making a better enzyme. It's also a matter of counting how many ways there is to make it.
So that's what I. So now let's just exactly, Boris. So now please let's just ask. That's what I want to do. I have one piece of data. It's not enough. And why we didn't do it again, because now I'd like to ask this kind of question. And please now, this is where I need help. I need input. Please tell me how to think about it. Here is my simple way of thinking about it. Here is my one piece of data. Now tell me, does this make sense? Or what should we do? We're poised now. We can do this. So here's my simple way. We physicists like energy landscapes. We usually draw them upside down, but when they're fitness, they're mountain landscapes. So this is some sort of enzyme, and presumably nature has made it more or less perfect, or pretty damn good, particularly HRP, for its particular function. But what we want to do is find a new function, right? So how do you do this? How do you cross this gap, this chasm, to the new function? Where do you go? And so what we did was we did an initial selection, which is a neutral selection. We found a whole bunch of enzymes that are different enzymes. They're not the natural one, but that work just as well. And then, so it's like taking two steps. And then we found one that does this new function better. That's really what the strategy we did. This is called a neutral selection. It's something that people suggest should be done, but you can't do that with standard techniques. It's only because you can do the screening so rapidly that you can do that. And so we did two rounds. We found basically 100 active mutants out of 10 to the 7. So my question is that's one experiment. Is that a natural number or not? I don't know.
100 active mutants, does it mean you find 100 mutations you can put in various ways to get this kind of neutral thing, or do you get 100 genotypes, like 100 sequences altogether?
We sequenced about 100. We did the statistics, and we predicted it would be about 200 given the library that we had.
But we didn't see almost all single mutants.
There were a few, not just one, a few. But yes, small number.
But within these 100 sequences, you found on the order of 200?
Within this 10, library of 10 to the 7, we found roughly 200, okay, 100 different unique features. So that's a part in 10 to the 5. What's that related to? Is that could just be this particular experiment. Or it could be something, and if you think about this, is maybe not a bad strategy for having mutations be sort of available for nature to do it. In other words, mutations, if they were so rare, they would almost never occur. If they were too rapid, you'd mutate all the time. But if they were sort of a step with not too easy, and a second step, maybe that's not a bad way of having it available. I don't know. This is just one number. Is this a worthwhile number to look at? Something we could do.
Where this mutation, I suppose there is an active site that is characterized, and it's not from mutation they were.
So we looked at that, and I'm not enough of an expert to tell you, but it turns out that no. Some of the mutations are well away from the active site.
The natural one.
But those things appeared. You got like mixtures of those. These always appeared in when we sequenced.
They were placed differently, the mutation, and in the second run they were closer to the catalytic site because there was a mutation.
Usually there were, but not always.
I'm curious. Did you take your super fit mutation, say mutated singing, cut it off its membrane anchor? Did you look at its normal?
No.
Situations, whether...
No, but when I calculate the diffusion limit, I account for the fact that it's bound to a surface.
You're really evolving. I mean, you're evolving something in its native environment. You might evolve, you know, the catalytic aspect of it, but the folding aspects of it. And
of course. Absolutely.
Wrong with it, but it's just useful.
Absolutely. 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 But you're evolving it so it works better for what you're asking it to do. But that's all you can do. That's the pressure that you're putting on.
You don't mutate, why if you don't find it in the active site?
It may, yes. You're absolutely right.
Supposing you can do this, it is an open question. What fraction of mutations in real proteins are effectively neutral? And if you could process enough variants, more than the average population size it's working on, say a billion, it would not be surprising if you could make a new enzyme that's better. That would be answer a fundamental question that we can't really answer just by staring at sequences.
Right, so a billion is sort of at the edge of what we can do, but it's not far. You might run it for 10 days, so it's about.
You try to challenge yourselves in some way, your situation, given high temperature, whatever. Challenge your system, try to steer it in another way.
I say we did. It's just not the way you want. You say high temperature. So maybe it unfolds just right, so it's, you know, it's always, whatever, the point about any directed evolution, the point you get something that works better for the pressure you put it on. You're absolutely right.
I'm just asking whether you did exactly the same experiment, but in some different manner. I mean, you raise the temperature. I wonder whether it would be informative to see if
you have any more slides.
Yeah?
Maybe they allow an answer.
No, it doesn't. I mean, we haven't done it. Yes.
I wonder whether it would be informative to see where your limitation is, right? If you have the two data sets.
We don't have two data sets.
But you're detecting sort of the total fluorescence in the droplet, right? So you're also sensitive to how much of that peroxidase is actually displayed. So, for example, you'll also pick up mutations which will make peroxidase easier to export or whatever, easier to display.
Absolutely. You're making only, it's not that you're making a faster enzyme for the conditions that you're doing the experiment. There's no question about that. No question. That's always a struggle you have when you do these experiments. Always. But still, it's asking, you are making a new enzyme. It's doing something different. It is not the same peak that it was before.
Just out of curiosity, did you optimize the codon context before you did this?
Optimize what?
The codon context. I mean, what was the codon context that you use?
I'm afraid that's language that I don't understand. Yes.
Was it a yeast gene?
So there are different codon. I just wonder whether you just use the bacterial. I wonder what it's.
It's not a bacteria. It's a horseradish. It's a plant. You're thinking exactly right. Let me finish. It's my turn. You're thinking exactly right. You're thinking ahead to what we can do. I'm just telling you what we did. It's not that we've done everything. We just started something. And so please just write all these things down. Those are great things to try.
No, I was just wondering about something else, if you didn't optimize the context in advance, whether you actually saw it being optimized in the end of your experiment. Maybe it's something useful for you to look at. That's what I'm asking.
So your point about this being very large jumps calls to mind replica exchange Monte Carlo, where oftentimes with optimization problems, you really have to separate your population into many different samples and have them operating under different constraints. But one step that seems to be very critical in is the slow relaxation. Once you make some large jump to a different temperature, that every system gets to then find its local minimum or maximum. Is that built in here, or are you only making the large jumps when you explore sequence space, or does every new sequence somehow have a chance to make some?
I'm not sure what you mean by relaxing. If it means finding local mutations or small changes, the answer is no. If it means just folding itself so it operates, the answer is yes, because if it doesn't fold itself to operate, it won't work.
But so every time you make a new library, each change is, if I understood correctly, a relatively large one in sequence space where there may be three or four different mutations and some shuffling. So is there a way to couple that with an intermediate stage where you allow for point mutations that then?
All of these things are possible subject to the constraint that there's only a certain number that you can do, which is roughly, for doing it with yeast, is roughly 10 to the 7. That's the limitation.
So if you look at one of these 100 mutants, how many changes on average does it have from the
two
changes? Okay, so it's not a huge jump.
Yeah. Okay. Here's why this makes sense. If I just compare doing the whole thing with robots and microfluidics, if you did it with robots, it would take 5,000 liters of reagent. It took 150 microliters total reagent. That's by doing it in picoliters, right? It would have taken about 2 years to do it with robot. It took about 7 hours of sorting, not counting all the extra time, which was not insignificant, but it's not 2 years. It would have cost about $15 million to do it with robots. The biggest cost, by the way, is the cost of the tips, even at 4 cents a tip. The biggest cost is just the cost of the tips, making all those reactions. We estimate it costs about $2.50. We can reuse our chips. So,
how many truckloads of tips
would that be? I didn't factor in the disposal costs.
Yeah. Or the transportation.
Common sense, yeah.
So, this is what we're replacing. Okay, so all your questions, which I don't even begin to know the answers with, now you're sort of poised to do. You can do these things. You can ask these kinds of questions because you have this high rate of doing experiments. Let me see. Let me just briefly show you a couple of the other things that you can do. What did I just do? I encapsulated a cell. I sorted cells. What do you normally do? How do you normally sort cells? It's that fax machine, right? The only thing is, think about it for a minute. How do fax machines work? Fax machines work, you hydrodynamically flow focus the cells into a stream. You get this nice uniform stream of water with the cells all nicely separated. You interrogate each cell with a laser, with 9 lasers if you want. It's a little difficult because now this is a stream of flowing water and air. You interrogate the cell. You say, oh, I like this one. You break the cell into drops. You charge up the drops. You put them in an electric field, and you sort them. Well, we've done the same thing, except not in air. And if you think about it, we've encapsulated the cells, and we incubate them. We add things. And we do all kinds of things. And then we interrogate them, and then we sort them. So this is what I call a functional fax machine. So it lets you do everything you do with a fax machine, but the cell is in the microenvironment for arbitrary amounts of time first. And then you do the sort. So I'll go through all this. So by the way, you're always limited to the Poisson statistics. That's, by the way, the limitation on fax machines. We figure we can do, say, 5,000 drops a second, subject to the Poisson statistics. A fax machine, if it's really doing well, if they have lots of errors, it's not, but if it's really doing well, the same rate that we are, they do about 10,000 per second, turns out. They tell you they do 100,000 per second, but they don't. Not if they run them so it's really accurate. And it's limited by Poisson statistics. Oh, look at this. One of our colleagues in the medical school figured a way to hydrodynamically order cells or drops. This is a flowing stream. He's ordered these are beads, but you can do the same thing with cells. He's ordered them, and so if you count the number of cells, the number of drops that have a single cell in them, it's 95%. So you beat Poisson statistics. So even Poisson statistics are not a limitation. There are various ways of beating that. But now, look, here's another experiment that you can do. Let me tell you another little tiny story. How do you make antibodies, monoclonal antibodies? Anybody know? No? So this is my simple physicist way. You will correct me all my mistakes, but just bear with me all the mistakes I tell you. What you do is you inoculate an animal, a mouse, a monkey, a rabbit, with some peptide of interest. You let the animal build up resistance to the peptide. Then you kill the animal. You take the spleen that has a large number of B cells. You want to then choose that B cell. Each B cell will produce a single antibody. You want to choose the B cell that produces the antibody that binds to the peptide. The trouble is you have to test each of these B cells. So what you do is you combine all the B cells with melanoma cells, with cancer cells, to immortalize them, to make them grow. The efficiency of that's part in 10 to the 5. Very inefficient. You grow them up then, one per well, or plate them out, grow them up for about 2 weeks until you have enough monoclonal antibodies, and then you test. You do an ELISA test to see if it binds to the the peptide of interest. Well, what if we just took that, say, hybridoma, and put it into a drop? Then we have in a drop, and you calculate, the drop is really small. Calculate the production of antibodies. In 2 hours, you produce the same concentration of antibodies that you do with the ELISA. So you just have to do ELISA in the drop. How do you do that? Well, you can take the a bead. This is a simple way. Take a bead that's coated with the peptide that you're interested in. If they bind, then they'll all bind to the bead. You add a second antibody that binds to any antibody, and this is fluorescently labeled. And then you just look, is the bead light up or not? And you can see that. Here are beads that light up, and you can do experiments, and you can see that. So you can do that. Here's an improved example. Now, but wait a minute. I said you're doing it on a single cell. You just lost, what is it? 10 to the 5, you've got one cell. You've lost most of the cells because you've immortalized them. But why do you have to immortalize them? So just take the spleen and sort through them all. Why not? You can do that. Of course, then you say, look, I've done it in a mouse. Really what I'm interested in, of course, is human. A goat, why not human? Well, usually you don't like to sacrifice the human to get their spleen. But if you can sort them that fast, why do you get the spleen? Why not just take the blood? You can just take the B cells from the blood. You don't have to immortalize them. So you look directly. So you screen blood. So what do? Well, it means if there are patients that have developed immunity, they have antibodies already for some disease. Screen them, you have human antibodies right away. So you can mine them. So of course, this now becomes something that's real, and I can't do that anymore in my lab. So several people in my lab are trying to start a little company, HABSEL, Harvard Antibody Selection, to try and do that. It's not too much that we just can't do that anymore. Let me show you one other thing. We talked last night about sequencing, right? Well, this is my colleague Bob Westerfeld, yes?
If you don't immortalize the cell lines, how are you going to keep producing them?
Then you have to do PCR to pull out to amplify just that section. You just put primers in, and you do PCR to pull out only those part of the antibodies, and you can do it, you just start with that. Pardon?
Well, it's off topic. You know, you can put the whole spleen on the fax machine. It will take you an hour from one mouse.
But there's no, because the fax machine, there's no way of doing this assay to see what antibody the cell is producing unless you put it in a small enclosed capsule microenvironment of a few picoliters for a few hours. You have to put it in drops first. So let me show you another thing. Well, okay, we can. It turns out that oil is not very conductive of heat. How do you heat water? What's the easiest way of heating water?
Microwave.
A microwave. Microwave is very close to the frequency of the sort of the microwave frequency is close, but not quite right. It's close to the frequency that's used for a lot of fiber optic propagation. So you can buy essentially microwave generators for very cheaply. You can put wires around these things, so you can make little microwave heaters. And you can heat the drop by about 20 or 30 degrees really rapidly. It takes about a few milliseconds. It's a very small drop. If you can heat and cool drops, you can cool them, just put it here. Bring it away from the heater. What can you do? Oh, you can do PCR. Oh, what about doing PCR? Clever idea. What about doing PCR? Well, here's another idea that we have. I won't try this. What about doing sequencing directly on the drops?
Can we do that?
Well, you know these gene chips, the Affymetrix chips, you could actually, in principle, use that to sequence. You could sequence the whole genome with a chip. The way you do that is you put on each place, you put a certain number, known number of oligos, some oligo that you know, and you hybridize against that, right? And you just hybridize something like that. You could do it. It turns out it's not the right thing to do. It's very expensive. There are companies that are trying to do this, but you can also do this by replacing each spot with a drop. And so let me just show you how we might do that. This is the way you can think of doing it. You can take the genomic DNA, shear it down. You always shear it down. You always do this for sequencing. But now shear it down not to the standard length that you normally sequence, which is about 20 to 30, maybe 100 bases. But you can shear it down to 1,000 mers. Take each of those 1,000 mers and put it into a drop, actually a big drop, about a nanoliter, and amplify it with PCR. You can do that now pretty easily. So now you have lots and lots of copies of that. And then you build a library of oligos, say of 6 mers. You build a library of all the possible 6 mers. And you put that library against this unknown 1,000 mer and ask which of those 6 mers binds to that drop. Well, it turns out that's pretty easy to do. You do this, and then we built what we call a pico injector. Whoops. Oh, dear. I think I had a slide. The movie of it. Oh, it doesn't show. Okay, I have another slide where it'll show. I'm sorry. It's designed like this. I'm sorry, this move. Oh, there, you can see it. It's not running, but these drops move by, and this is the genomic DNA. This is a random set of libraries, but each of them is barcoded, and you just inject picoliter. No, pico injector. This is controllable, so we could put electric field, but you don't need that. You can just use surface tension to control this. It's a very, very simple device. And so you build this and you detect it. And then you just ask which ones detect. It turns out that if you really are serious about wanting to do it fast, you don't want to detect it with a laser anymore because that's too slow. What you do is you want to use a camera. And so some really clever guys in my lab realized that you can do that pretty easily. These are actually drops. Notice each one has a little spot on it. How do we get the spot there? Well, actually, we just illuminate it with a white light. The drop is a lens, and it focuses the light. And so each of these has a drop right below it. So it's very, image analysis is simple. Now you can just do this. And we estimate we can easily detect, and this is reading fluorescence, which is what we're going to read. We actually read FRET, but it's fluorescence. You can easily detect and read 1,000 drops per second. Now that gets up to be a large number. Moreover, you can parallelize everything. Here's this is the pico injector. This is, we actually could design it so we could inject different things, but you can see we're just using one. This is running much faster than it looks. We can just gang a 1,000 of these or 100 of these together. This is just a thing showing that we can parallelize the drop making. We're making lots and lots of drops. Everything can be parallelized. Okay? So, sorry, my slide, my movies aren't working here. This is a simple way of figuring out what the sequence is. It's not the right way. But you can see that if I have all the 6 mers, this one hybridizes, then I look for the next one that hybridizes, and I've just sequenced one base. And I just tile it along and do that. Actually, the right way of doing it, the right way of doing it, oh, here's the device. The right way of doing it is to think that each of these 1,000 mers has, it turns out, on average, about a 1,000 different 6 mers that binds to it, and has a unique 1,000 6 mers. So you can think of it having an address of 1,000 elements. and that defines that sequence. That's a lot of elements of the address. So now it becomes sort of a bioinformatics problem. But the point is that, roughly speaking, one drop sequence one base. And that's where you save. Then you just calculate. How many drops? What's the cost of a drop? And how fast do I make a drop if I parallelize? And here's some numbers. You only have 1/6 mon in a drop. Here's the simple-minded numbers.
But your sequence, your 1,000 mark, could have...
We've thrown it against all 4,000 and 4,000 different drops.
Say you got a certain 6 mark. There could be more than one site.
So it could, yeah. So that's a problem. So that's, there's some strategies that we have to avoid that. Right. So there's a lot of potential. That becomes a bioinformatics problem or a bioinformatics opportunity. And there's lots of ways of avoiding that. I haven't, the right way, you don't just do hybridization, you do a hybridization, two hybridizations and a ligation. That makes it real easy to detect. You can separate things. If you do it right, you can, for the same number of drops, you can get libraries that are either 7 or 8 MERS. You can separate them by having some free base pairs. There's lots of tricks you can do. But this is why it's interesting. Just go through the number. The cost per base is 2/1,000,000 of a cent. I just calculated the cost of all the oligos and the primers and everything in a picoliter. The time it takes is 10^-6 seconds. If you want a genotyping, it's about 2 cents in 1 second. If you want to sequence the whole genome, it's about $200 in 3 hours. So this gets interesting. This sort of gets to be to the point where this $1,000 genome is within reach. This is not the current technology. Is all the current fashionable technology is all single molecule stuff, nanopores and the zero mode waveguides and all this, and they are beautiful technologies. People have been working on nanopores in my institution. They've been working on them for 13 years, and as far as I can tell, they are about the same place in sequencing as they were 13 years ago. It definitely will work. It just will take some time. This is very boring, but I think it actually will work because we're not using any technology. It's true, right? Pardon? Well, I don't care. I'm not ashamed of that. I'll say that. It's scalable. So of course we can't do it anymore ourselves. We start a little company. It's actually an interesting company because it turns out that if you want to try and actually get people to give you money to hire enough engineers to do this, they won't anymore. Because there's this company, PacBio, started by the guys at Cornell, who those of us, Cal Craig, Watwed, real heroes of ours, beautiful company. They've raised $350 million. They still don't have anything that works. But there's so much money that's gone into this that there's no more money to be had. So what we did, we teamed with some other guys who had this very clever idea. What do you do if you have this ability to sequence really cheaply? What you really want to do is build a library of genotype and phenotype. And so they have this very creative way, basically using social networking, like Facebook, to encourage people to donate. If it's $40 for genotyping, $20 for genotyping, you'll do it. You go to all the people who have particularly breast cancer, go to the all the foundations, and say, please, will you donate? We'll give you if you donate your genotype and phenotype for $40, we'll give $20 of that to the Breast Cancer Foundation, and we'll put your information in a library. It'll be completely anonymous. But if somebody then uses that library and finds something of value, you'll get a little hit. Oh, you've helped cure breast cancer, things like this. And so you can imagine building a library. You build a library. You make it freely accessible. Anybody can use it. But if you find a hit, then 20% of your license fees come back to the library owner. What model does that remind you of? What big IT company is it that knows how to do searches with large databases? right? Google. Anybody here of the company 23andMe? Started by the wife of Sergey Brin, the founder of Google, basically to do the same thing, except they didn't quite have the way of monetizing it. This is a way of monetizing it. But you need to have the input. You need to have the cheap way of finding the information. This is the way you can do it. So, I don't know, we're trying to get somebody to believe in this and give us enough money to at least develop it to the point where we can see if it works. Here's one other thing. This is the last thing, just one slide. You can do metagenomics. So if you look in the soil, almost all organisms, almost all bacteria in the soil cannot be cultured in the lab. We just don't know how to culture them. But it would be interesting to look inside of them and learn something about them. Here's a simple way of doing it. The problem with the drops is it's really good for doing an assay where you don't have to wash. Notice I never wash things. There are a lot of assays where you like to wash things. Here's a way of washing them. Okay, what we do is, we go in, we put a single bacterium in a drop, but then we gel the drop. We make it into agar or polyacrylamide. Just make it into a gel. And we use a trick that, this is basically George Church's trick. We bind one of the PCR primers to the gel. Actually, you don't even have to do that. You can bind a piece, covalently bind a piece of DNA, and then hybridize a primer, one primer to that. The other primer is free. Then you just take these and you put them in drops and do PCR. Okay, the heating is enough to lyse the cells. If not, you can add something to lyse them. You do PCR, and you pick out those cells that have, if you amplify something, just use something that fluorescently labels the amplified DNA, you pick out those that have that particular gene that you're doing PCR. But you might ask, for example, we're asking, can they carry some disease, and are they resistant to antibiotics? So then, once we sort these, if they're in a gel, we can break the emulsion, wash everything. The genomic DNA is so large, it won't go out of the gel. Only the amplified amplified product will go out, and then put in a second set of primers and do it again, and then find those that have two different things. So we can do this multiple times, and it's just essentially this. You do put the bacterium in a drop, you gel it, then you add the PCR reagents, you do PCR, you sort out one, you wash, do it again. You can do it as many times as you want. The genomic DNA is so large that it'll stay put. So it's a very simple way of doing metagenomics for screening things. And so we're trying to screen bacteria. We have another project trying to look for new restriction enzymes. Turns out restriction enzymes, we've run out, or NEB has run out of finding new restriction enzymes. They really like to do it by doing panning through the bacteria in the soil. They have no way of doing it. They have a nice assay that looks for restriction enzymes. Makes a cell, a reporter cell, light up. Restriction enzymes. So there's a lot of things now that, again, we're poised to do. So, sorry for going on so long. These are some of the people who contributed to the work. What I tried to do is tell you a little bit about engineering. Boring, I know. But try and show you the power now, the tools that we have available to actually quantify, to ask quantitative questions about things like how things can evolve, about questions of this sort. So now I let you tell me what are the best things to do, what are really good things to do. We're just looking for interesting applications. I don't know, that's what I want to learn, I don't know what the right questions to ask are with this power now we have to ask about how things evolve. But it is a new level of quantifiable answers with many orders of magnitude improvement on the numbers that you can screen. So you ought to be able to ask some interesting questions. They're in principle easy and cheap, in practice they take some time to do it. So we need to choose them judiciously. So we're open to that sort of thing.
So, Dave, maybe I can ask you to play devil's advocate for a second.
Please do.
I mean, so my lab is next door to steep quakes. And so one thing that I had not realized until I got there was that as things get smaller and smaller with fluidics, the amount of lab space that it takes up seems to conversely because of all the control apparatus that goes into it. And so, you know, your stories, I mean, all the stories involving microfluidics are super cool, but they seem to all end up with, and then it got really hard, and we made a company around it because it's just a really hard engineering problem. And I'm wondering what the prospects really are for, you know, benchtop microfluidics for the masses in the same way that, like, you know, cell biologists don't build their own microscopes anymore.
And okay, so let me say this, that we have a slightly different strategy than Steve, because we have to compete with him. We do. So our strategy is not to get lots and lots of equipment, but rather what's happened in my lab, it's also very crowded, because kids really want to do this. So we need a little stand for each of them. So we buy $1,000 microscopes from China. We buy so bloody many syringe pumps that Harvard Apparatus gives us a really good deal because we keep threatening to go elsewhere. We buy a bunch of syringe pumps, a tiny little computer, maybe a laser, maybe not, and that's it. Sometimes we put a high-speed camera. Usually we just put a high shutter speed camera. So we can put together a set. It really takes about this much space, and we do it for about $5,000 if we're being on the high end. So we do it really cheaply. So what the time-consuming thing is that why the difference between what we do and what you want to do in the company is if you want to do it every day, the same thing, routinely, that's tough. If you want to do it in a university environment, then you have to solve the problems and it takes a while. And so, you know, our sorter doesn't always work and so we're always fine-tuning it. And the surfactant, the concentrations, the type of surfactant, we never get it exactly right. We have to fine-tune it. So that's what takes the time. It's a lot of fiddling. If you want to sell it as an instrument so that a technician can do it, then you have to solve all those problems absolutely. And that is just not something that's ideally suited for a physics lab. It's not even ideally suited for an engineering lab. It's really you need a team of people to do that. And so that's, to me, where why you want a company, because if you want to make it, make something that's usable by everybody, you have to. But if you want to just have students doing it, it's not very hard. And so, you know, my students take a month or so to learn all the tricks, and then they're doing it. But, you know, it took 4 years to do this first sort. I think we can do it faster than that, but not that much faster. I mean, it probably takes 6 months to do the experiment. You have to learn get the assay to work. You have to learn all the biology that we need. We have to find the right biologists to collaborate with. That's the time. So I disagree that it takes, you know, more and more control equipment. We keep it all simple, but it takes, you know, you have to think through, you have to get everything right. So yeah, it's not trivial, but it's not that hard. If you want to commercialize it, then it is.
Have you played around with the surfactant, trying different types of lipids that themselves may have sorting capabilities?
No. That would be a great idea. So we do a lot of our work with Andrew Griffiths, who's he had the basic idea of encapsulating things in drops, and that's really when we realized that we got the whole idea of what we ought to do once we had that microfluidics. We married our microfluidics with a lot of what he does. And he had a postdoc He's in Strasbourg right now. He had a postdoc working on developing new surfactants, and they actually made many improved versions. We still use the one that we developed because we convinced Raindance to make it, and they'll give it to anybody who wants it, so we don't have to be chemists to do that. But there's enormous opportunity to do a good job in surfactants.
You could think that you could do some real chemistry, biochemistry within a system like that. If you have these lipids that potentially can partition, and they themselves could have, you construct them so that they have an affinity for an enzyme or a substrate, you could then use that system to sort an enzymatic product.
Yep.
Really interesting.
So one of the limitations of the high throughput sequencing now is the length of the sequence. So, I mean, Illumina is up to maybe 200 bases. You can't assemble a human genome with 200 base sequences. There's just too much redundancy. So, I mean, you were talking about a KB, and I'm just wondering what the limitations are. You were using 6 MERS in there.
I know how it scales. If I go up to a 7 mer, I know how to get a 7 mer and a 6 mer library. Yeah. If I go to an 8 mer, then I need, you know, 4 times the library. And it's all a trade-off. Then I have to have better labels. I can think I can do it. I just, you know, everything I've done is doing just stupid calculations from ignorant people. I think if you did some true bioinformatics, you could really optimize this enormously. And so right now, all my calculations are based on doing 1,000 mers. But if you tell me, look, I really want to use larger templates, you can do it. I thought the limit was that it's hard to do PCR much greater than 1,000. You tell me how, because I need to do PCR.
There's long PCR now. The problem with PCR too is it's mutagenic. But there is long PCR that you can get up to around 4 kb or so.
We haven't done any optimization. Again, that's why I say that we need to have a team of people to be able to do this properly. I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about what the issues are.
But I would say that almost everybody agrees that's the issue, is that the tiny fragment sizes you're getting with Illumina. Even 4x4 is up to 500 or 600. So anything you can do to figure out to get longer continuous sequences.
Well, I've always thought that our limitation was just the PCR, because we need lots of copies. If there's a way around that, then we can do.
Well, they're doing this paradigm sequencing, or paradigm stuff now too, and that gets you bigger fragments, but still you got the gap in the middle, you don't know what that is.
Basically, any assay that you can do on a chip or on a bead, you can do more easily in a drop and with much less cost.
Don't take this the wrong way. What you've done is wonderful and extraordinary, but most of it is doing things that we already do much faster.
Yes.
That's a great thing to do.
Yes.
But there's another question that comes to mind. Usually when there's a new technology, it offers up the opportunity of doing something that you can't do.
Yes.
I was wondering what insights you had on that. That's of course being very nasty, since you already are such a wonderful thing.
I disagree. It's not being nasty at all, because you see, I'm gonna throw it back and tell you, I'm just building tools. I'm trying to get you to think differently. So you tell me what can you do. So there. You know, I can answer that question exactly like that. That is my whole point. So what is it that's really different? The thing that's really different in my view is that this is a way of doing facts that you can't do. And so the hybridomas, for example, you can't do other ways. So that's not something that you can do today. That's the thing that, to me, is most different. But then I would say that if you look at the simple directed evolution, it's just doing it faster. But have a chance to even ask the question, does a neutral selection, experimentally, is it good to do that or not? You can't ask that question. It's been done once with one selected mutant. That's not really asking the question. So that's something that you haven't been able to do. And all you've got to do it faster.
Well, that's not strictly true. That has been done with a lot of the antibody FAB fragments and phage display that people have done, the going through multiple rounds of mutagenesis and everything. But I agree, you can do this in a way that is unimaginable. We're talking about a million years' work you can do in an afternoon. And that's
so, I mean, the right way of asking, of answering your question is that you told me as well that when you grew up, like me, we use vacuum tubes, right? Now, did you think in those days that you'd have a phone that would get online?
I mean, in those days I watched Disney and he told me we'd find alternative universes based on silicon rather than...
Exactly. I mean, so just being able to do things faster, I can't think of everything. But I can put it out there for you to think of things. So that's the way I view it. So I don't think it's a nasty question. I mean, it's exactly the point.
Should we do this over